Committee on Healthcare Access of the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open a public hearing for the purpose of hearing from the sponsor on HB 2952. Then I'll close that public hearing after we hear from Representative Tomei and go to 2801, and then we'll finish the activities with 3502 today. So I open a public hearing, if I haven't already, on HB 2952. Representative Tomei?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you letting me speak first, since I'm supposed to be in another committee. I am, for the record, I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative from House District 41, representing the City of Milwaukee and parts of Southeast Portland. And thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 2952. Colleagues, House Bill 2952 stems from a news article attached to my written testimony, and she's just now passing it out. And my testimony is in the front, and then after that is the Oregon Health News. And if you open up to the second page of that, you will see, I think, highlighted an article that I got in October of 06 that stated that that 13 Oregon Health Plan contractors do not share the salaries of their CEOs. So I'm going to go on to talk about that. Currently, commercial insurers must disclose executive salaries to the Oregon Insurance Division when filing their annual statements. Contractors with the Oregon Health Plan do not. 2952 would require insurance contractors with the Oregon Health Plan to file more detailed reports itemizing administrative costs. The issue here is efficiency and transparency. The Oregon Medical Assistance Programs currently requires Oregon Health Plan contractors to file annual reports similar to the commercial insurer version. However, the administrative information contained in those reports is aggregated according to certain categories. It is not detailed enough to determine many specific administrative items like CEO salaries. As legislators, we carefully watch agency administrative dollars. These are taxpayer dollars being spent for administrative purposes, and prudent oversight demands more detailed scrutiny. Since the original drafting of the bill, we've talked with OMAP personnel and have fleshed out more precisely the administrative figures that would be most beneficial. And in my written testimony, I wrote that those were not available. However, I did include on a separate paper the proposed language, which LC is working on. They clean up the language of the bill, making it clear exactly who must file the OMAP reports and detail specific administrative costs to be reported. I will have that amendment soon, and it is detailed there in the information that I gave you. House Bill 2952 provides an important accountability tool for monitoring OHP contractors, and thank you for consideration on this bill.
Thank you. Are there questions of Representative? No? I have a question. And it's a serious question. What difference does it make whether we know the salary of the CEO? I mean, we know it of all those other people, and their salaries are astronomical.
I think it's important, Chair Greenlick, thank you for asking that question. I think it's important to know what the CEOs pay. If the other health plans have to offer it, give us that information, why wouldn't, when the Oregon Health Plan, where we're using citizens' dollars to pay for that insurance, why wouldn't we want to know how much their CEOs are getting paid?
So we're talking here only about the fully capitated health plans? Is that your intention?
Yes. Yes. And I met with OMAP, with staff from OMAP, and there were other itemized charges that they would like to have, which are in the proposed amendment on that last paper that I gave you.
I have to say, I look at those salaries, I'm always appalled by them because I'm still back in a different era. But having public doesn't seem to be any shame element that stops them from
going
crazy.
Chair Greenlee, I can appreciate what you're saying, but I still think all of that should be public information, especially if we're using public dollars to pay for the executive salaries.
Thank you, Representative.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Thank you very much, and thank you for allowing me to speak first.
There is only one person that signed up in opposition, so why don't we bring her forward? And Cindy Becker, will you come forward and be somewhat brief?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the Executive Director of Coalition for Healthy Oregon, which is an association that includes 11 of the 14 fully capitated health plans. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this bill. We are in opposition to it for several reasons. First of all, the fully capitated health plans have huge reports, financial reports, that they make to the Department of Human Services. Here is the reports, the instructions, and there's an incredible amount of detail that they do have to provide on a quarterly and on an annual basis. What we're trying to figure out is, again, similar to what Representative Greenlee asked, it seems like there's a solution in search of a problem. We're not quite sure what the problem is. The fully capitated health plans' combined administrative dollars are approximately 8%, which is less, in fact, than the commercial health plans. And we feel this is somewhat discriminatory, if you will. I'm not quite sure why this is being honed in on the fully capitated health plans. If this is an issue around transparency, why does it include all the providers that contract with the Department of Human Services, nursing homes, long-term care facilities, any provider? We're not quite sure what the issue is specifically with the fully capitated health plans. I know that Representative Tomei has received some information from the Department of Human Services. We'd be happy to meet with her about that because I think there may be some misconception about what is and what is not included in the reports that are already provided. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, a question about salaries. The fully capitated health plans the administrative piece of that, some of it they do the public dollars, but they also manage private commercial insurance programs
as
well.
That's my favorite.
And so do you disclose your salary on the commercial side? I mean, I'm not quite sure how you would parse that out.
Representative Marr, I'm Representative Greenlee. What would happen is that it would just be allocated. That portion of the salary that was attributable to the OHP, the health plan, would be included in the reports Representative Tomei is talking about, if this bill were to pass.
Representative Cannon?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Cindy, I guess it's just not quite clear to me why a organization that's primarily funded by public dollars would resist disclosing as much financial information as the public policymakers thought prudent and useful and informative. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that. I'm just having trouble understanding whether it stems from some competitiveness concerns or other reasons why we as policymakers should be worried that we'd be there would be unintended consequences of this. I'm not seeing them.
Representative Cannon, Representative Greenlee, members of the committee. It's not that the fully capitated health plans are trying to hide anything. We already provide an incredible amount of information. There's a line item in the reports around administration. It's a compilation of all the administrative costs. We're not quite sure what getting that information is going to do and why the fully capitated health plans were singled out. If you want to require this of everybody, great, but we're not quite sure what the issue was that precipitated specifically for the fully capitated health plans. If this is important, why isn't everybody else included in this bill?
Follow up, Mr. Chair, just to point out on the discriminatory side, we do require, as Representative Tobey pointed out, we do require commercial insurers to disclose executive salaries. So their claim could be that it's discriminatory not to ask the same of fully capitated managed health care plans. So just that.
Okay.
Representative Minnis?
Cindy, could you just give us a range? Give us an average amount from lowest to highest.
I don't have that information with
yes.
me.
Could you guess? Could you give me some idea? You have no idea.
An average amount. I would say the average would be between $100,000 and $200,000.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Much lower than the average of the commercials, actually, if that's true.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd only like to make a comment because I did sign on to this bill with Representative Tomei, and I was surprised because as a public school administrator, everybody knows my salary. And it's very easy.
And it's not enough, right?
Well, I'm not going to say whether it's enough or not, but it certainly is public knowledge. And I was surprised that it wasn't for this entity also. But anyway, I'm learning.
Thank you. Cindy, thank you. Okay, now that we've got the controversial stuff out of the way, I close the hearing on HB 2952. And open a hearing on HB 2801, which I assume will be an easy and non-controversial one. We do have two hearings we have to deal with today. We need to allocate the time. So I am going to try and keep some semblance of order in these two hearings. We had a carry 3502 over from the last session. I don't want to do that again. So, Representative Grigio, Senator Bates here too. Oh boy, we have a high-powered team. I open a public hearing on HB 2801. I may be double opening these, but that's all right. Representative Grigio, age before beauty today.
Age and brains before beauty, Mr. Chair.
Wow, I just call it a day.
I'm here, you know.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Larry Galizio. I'm State Representative for House District 35. Wanted to thank you, Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee for the opportunity today. And we have a host of invited testimony that I think will be very useful for the committee. So I'm going to try to be somewhat brief, but I want to explain why the origin, well, not so much the origin of the bill, the reason for the bill. So on July 19th, 2006, the President, not Senator Courtney, but the President of the United States, vetoed legislation that had passed both the Senate and the House that would have lifted the funding restriction on embryonic stem cell research. And as described in a bipartisan letter to the President, which was signed by over 50 United States senators, states that stem cell research, including embryonic stem cell research, has the potential to treat and help us better understand deadly and disabling diseases affecting more than 100 million Americans, including cancer, heart disease, diabetes, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, spinal cord injuries, and others, unquote. In response, the citizens and state legislatures of California, Connecticut, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Illinois have all adopted legislation encouraging embryonic stem cell research. Five of the six states that I just mentioned, excluding Massachusetts, have established publicly funded stem cell research programs. It just so happens, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that tomorrow, Tuesday, April 10th, the United States Senate will once again take up the debate on federal funding of stem cell research. While I'm hopeful that our federal partners will pass veto-proof legislation that removes the federal funding restrictions, I believe that we've waited long enough and that it's time for Oregon to take the lead along with the aforementioned states and empower Oregon's biomedical research community by investing in the promising field of regenerative medicine. So with this in mind, I bring you House Bill 2801, and I want to note that the chair is the chief co-sponsor of this bill, and perhaps we can call it the Oregon Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act. You know, at the federal level, they're always naming the legislation. We never do that, so. But most of our HB 28 has four basic elements. Number one, it establishes the Human Stem Cell Research Committee, which would develop guidelines for research involving the derivation or use of embryonic stem cells. Second, it establishes the Human Stem Cell Research Grant Fund to seek public and private investments in stem cell or for stem cell research. Third, it requires healthcare providers delivering fertility services to provide information to patients about stem cell research. And fourth, it imposes penalties for failure to obtain written informed consent from donors prior to research. So today we're really fortunate to have medical researchers who can explain the science and really speak to the current and future research and applications. And additionally, we also have testimony from the perspective of current and future beneficiaries of stem cell research. So I'll leave you with three primary reasons why I've been party to this bill. Number one, I think that we, meaning those of us in this building, state legislators, have a moral imperative as policymakers to support ethical scientific research that helps people, especially those suffering from serious illness. Secondly, I think biomedical research, and especially regenerative medical research, holds enormous economic promise. And Oregon, with Oregon Health Sciences University already doing research with its stem cell center, that we in Oregon are poised to become a leader in this exciting field of medicine. And finally, I think this legislation sends a strong signal to the federal government. The overwhelming source of funds for medical research, of course, is the federal government. This legislation, should we pass it, sends that the people of Oregon believe that ethical scientific medical research shouldn't be held hostage to placate a vocal minority in the country. So today I stand figuratively with former First Lady Nancy Reagan, her son Ron Reagan Jr., Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, a host of Nobel laureates, and our nation's most distinguished scientists in seeking support for embryonic and all forms of promising and ethical stem cell research. And before I yield to Senator Bates, who is a co-sponsor on this, I wanted to apologize to the committee in advance, because right after this I'm going to leave. I should be chairing another committee at this time, but I'd be glad to take any questions. So thank you again for the opportunity.
I assume it's nothing important you're going to.
I'm going to take the fifth on that.
Are there any questions of Representative Luizio? Larry, thank you.
Thank
going
you.
Off to Ways and Means.
I want to hear those, Senator.
All right. Senator
thank
Bates?
You. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. I'll make my comments extremely brief because I, too, am supposed to be on the committee right now. But this is an important piece of legislation, so I want to make a few statements just real quickly. Back in the dark ages when I was in medical school, stem cells were sort of an ethereal, maybe they exist, maybe they don't exist, gosh, they must exist sort of thing. Since that time, we've had huge movement forward as far as our ability to identify human cells. We know for obviously for a fact they're real, they exist, and we can use them for helping people overcome serious illnesses. Having said that, I also believe that we're entering into a new golden age in medicine. We've actually passed through one with antibiotics and high-tech care, and we've extended the human lifespan probably 20 years since World War II. But we're kind of bumping up against the wall now of genetic defects and similar problems, some of the diseases you've mentioned, including muscular dystrophy than others, that we really haven't got any effective treatment for. Stem cell research is where I think we're going in the future, along with genetic research, for dealing with the basic problems we face as human beings as far as our health is concerned. You'll hear a lot more about this from people behind me who are experts in this field, which I am not. I'm just a family physician down in Medford, Oregon, but I see these illnesses every day. And I know that stem cell research holds only promise for these people, especially people who suffer from chronic diseases. We are going to see more chronic illnesses in the future. Our population is aging, and the cost and the human tragedy dealing with those is very real. Stem cell research offers us many ways of dealing with some of those illnesses and chronic illnesses that we see and will see in the future, and I think in greater numbers as the population ages. I also live in a part of the country where I get the news from California pretty regularly. California passed a $3 billion grant for stem cell research. They didn't do it with the legislature. They did it by a popular vote of the people. That's how strongly they felt in California. I believe that we are behind the curve on this as far as the legislative assembly is concerned, that the vast majority of Oregonians want us to go forward with stem cell research. They want us to do it now. Many people also tell me, gee, we're just 3.5 million people. This is just a little old Oregon. How can we do this? Oregon is a leader in health care as far as both what we do as far as we apply that health care and in research. We have a real gem at OHSU. and those bodies that work with OHSU, that we don't recognize ourselves, because so often you're not a prophet in your own land. We have an ability to step forward with this bill and go forward with stem cell research in a way that many other states simply can't do. We must take advantage of that opportunity, not only for the health of our citizens, but for people across the country. It's something that's achievable, and something we can do, but we need this kind of legislation to bring it forward. There also are issues I obviously understand about reproductive rights in this. I think this bill protects those reproductive rights very, very, very well. I think we're also going to find in the near future, as we've already started to find, that we can get stem cells from very different resources. We now know we can get some from amniotic fluid, but probably not in the mountain kind we need. The best source for it is still embryonic. But there are other methods that are going to become available, and without doing the research, we're not going to find those methods. So I would hope that the committee would consider this bill very carefully and give it your full support. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bates. Any questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Well, here's the plan. I'm going to start with a panel in favor, and then we'll have a panel opposed, and then all the rest of the witnesses on the list in favor will run as long as we can. So let's start with Dr. Dorsa, Dr. Don Wolf, and Dr. Michael Nguyen as the first panel. The next panel will be Dr. Nuremberg, Gail and Gary Snow, and Gail Atterbury.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman Greenlich and members of the subcommittee. My name is Don Wolf. I'm from Portland, representing OHSU. I recently retired from OHSU as a professor emeritus. I've been involved there for the last 10 years or so in using the monkey as a clinically relevant model for the human at the Oregon Regional National Primate Research Center in Beaverton, studying stem cells. In this case, the vast majority of the focus has been on rhesus monkey stem cells. I support House Bill 2801 and the creation of a Human Stem Cell Research Committee in the Department of Human Services that will oversee and catalyze human stem cell research in Oregon. Today I would like to share my excitement over this area of research. I will present in the course of a little bit of a slideshow here with 10 slides, a brief overview of embryonic stem cell field, the potentials for research using embryonic stem cells, and in the treatment of human disease. Most of the latter will be discussed by my colleagues here today. So I have 5 slides to try and introduce or give you a historical perspective into this field, and I would use ESC as a shortened form of embryonic stem cells. In this first figure, we have a definition. I see it's not coming up here, but at any rate, there we go. Thank you. So that's We have a definition of stem cell as a cell that can self-renew or that is capable of differentiation into many of the cells in the body. And this capacity is called pluripotency. Stem cell sources are multiple in nature. They include the developing embryo, so embryonic stem cells would be derived from the developing embryo, parthenotes, or eggs that have been tricked into developing without sperm presence, gonads, cord blood, and adult tissues. And while the pros and cons of each of these categories could be itemized, our focus here is on embryonic stem cells. A brief historical review. Embryonic stem cells were first derived in the mouse in 1981, and it wasn't until 1995 that embryonic stem cells were derived from primates, in this case, rhesus monkeys. And then in 1998, the same team, Dr. James Thompson's team at the University of Wisconsin, were successful in isolating human embryonic stem cells. And I might add that Dr. Thompson is internationally recognized as the father of primate ESC biology, and I can proudly report that he received some of his initial training right here in Oregon as a postdoctoral fellow in my laboratory group from 1989 to 1991. The next figure introduces the concept of deriving embryonic stem cells. So we start with a fertilized egg. We allow that egg to develop over the course of several days until it reaches a stage called the blastocyst, comprised of roughly 150 cells. The outer layer of cells will contribute exclusively to the placental membranes. The inner layer of cells that you can see there, are sort of a cluster of cells, are called the inner cell mass, and they will contribute to the developing fetus, and they contain the embryonic stem cells. So by selectively lysing that outer layer of cells and carefully removing the inner cell mass, placing it on a layer of feeder cells to nurture it, one can successfully isolate an embryonic stem cell line, which can then be characterized and eventually banked at low temperature for future use. So the uses could include a number of, from a basic science perspective, the ability to study mechanisms involved in cellular differentiation, cell expansion and self-renewal, also how cells work together in tissue development and regeneration in vitro. ESCs could be used in drug discovery, and in fact, each individual patient could participate in this or benefit from this by having the type of drug selected as well as the dosage and regimen that was going to be used. And finally, the most perhaps interesting and exciting aspect of ESL biology would be the use of these cells in cell-mediated treatment of human disease. One of the problems with treatment with this concept of using ESCs in the treatment of human disease is the probability that if you receive embryonic stem cells or derivatives of those stem cells that come from a donor, your immune system will recognize them as foreign and reject them. And that has brought about this concept of human therapeutic cloning, which I present in the next slide. Basically, it involves the removal of a somatic cell from the patient, in this case from a fibroblast from a skin biopsy. That cell then is transferred into an oocyte which has been enucleated, which is called a cytoplast. So that's the nuclear transfer step. And one then would allow that embryo, that nuclear transfer embryo, to grow to the blastocyst stage and then derive embryonic stem cells from that cloned embryo. Those could be frozen, then thawed, and directed to differentiate at some subsequent time when they were needed by the patient, and one would then have cells that are immunologically compatible with the patient. That's the huge advantage to this kind of approach. Looking at it in a little bit different perspective, or schematic representation, I just wanted to emphasize the importance of the cytoplast in this step. You see here, starting with the mature oocyte that goes to a cytoplast, then the nuclear transfer step takes place, and you create a fusion pair. Once that donor nucleus is inside the cytoplast, it's the role of the cytoplast to actually reprogram that donor nucleus so that it can direct the events of early development.
Is this material going to be on our final?
I'm sorry?
Is this material going to be on our final?
Yeah, absolutely.
I know whether to take notes or not.
So, quickly to show you how this works in terms of the steps that are involved. In enucleating the egg, here are three different approaches. You can see an egg. This is in the monkey. You can see an egg that's immobilized by a holding pipette, and the microtool to the right of each of these micrographs. The technology now has evolved over three generations, basically to the one in the down in the bottom center, where we use the birefringence of the spindle, which contains the DNA, the oocyte DNA, as a way of visualizing in real time that spindle so that we can remove it. And that's a 100% efficient process now. The next step is to do nuclear transfer. So we simply load the microtool with individual cells. These actually happen to be fibroblasts. And then in this panel, we're inserting the microtool through the outer layer of the cytoplast, depositing the cell, and then eventually removing the tool. Now that sets the stage. You have the fusion pair there, the cytoplast and the donor nucleus. You fuse those two with an electrical pulse and then activate development. Ultimately, you produce...
I'm afraid you're losing us.
Am I?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, we'll go to the final slide then,
okay.
I guess.
Okay.
The requirements for regenerative medicine, then, if I can itemize them. The first would be, of course, a source of pluripotent cells. And embryonic stem cells are perhaps the most pluripotent of any stem cells that we have mentioned. We need lots of them, and since embryonic stem cells can grow indefinitely, in culture one can generate huge numbers. You need cells that can be rapidly induced into desired phenotypes. That is to say, if you're treating a diabetic patient, that you can end up producing insulin-containing pancreatic beta cells. You need to be able to do that rapidly. Finally, the immune system compatibility is an issue that I've raised, and there I've listed here three possibilities. One is to generate banks of embryonic stem cell lines, like you can envision the analogy being with blood banks. This is possible, although probably impractical because of the large number of cell lines required to satisfy the general population's needs. Genetically modified embryonic stem cells is another possibility that we don't have time to discuss. And the third is therapeutic cloning, which I've introduced to you and which I can now say that we have had success in the monkey in generating proof of principle of this technology, the first time that it's happened in primates. And finally, these cells need to function after transplantation. And while many people are working on this, at the present time we can simply say that the results are not conclusive, but they're encouraging to date, although very limited. So in conclusion, this is an exciting time for those of us involved in ESL biology, for the potential still exists that this technology could revolutionize the practice of Western medicine. In my opinion, Oregon should, and in fact will, participate in this endeavor. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Next. Dan?
Yeah, I'll go next. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, my name is Dan Dorsa, and I serve as Vice President for Research at Oregon Health and Science University. My testimony today is to express our institution's support for House Bill 2801, which addresses stem cell research in Oregon. OHSU views stem cell research as one of the most promising areas for the development of new therapies to treat a wide variety of the chronic illnesses, which we heard about earlier, in Americans broadly and here in Oregon. Recognizing the enormous potential of these cell-based therapies, the OHSU research community believes there is still much more research to be done and carried out before the promise of stem cells can be fully realized. A key question remains to be answered, and that is whether the stem cells, which show the greatest therapeutic potential, must be derived from human embryonic sources. OHSU believes that the scientific community simply doesn't know the answer to this question yet. The answer can only be derived by ensuring access to these cells, as well as to cells derived from other sources, including those created through nuclear transfer and some of the other technologies that you heard about from Dr. Wolf. Inasmuch as federal policy has prevented access to federal funding for this research and has inhibited the use of embryonic stem cells, OHSU supports HB 2801, which will make it possible to conduct the necessary research to answer this important question. This is not to say that OHSU researchers will not pursue studies of alternate methods to produce stem cells with therapeutic potential. Indeed, in 2002, OHSU established the Oregon Stem Cell Center. Much of the work of this center is focused on understanding the genetic and molecular events that occur during embryonic development and that ultimately prompt a stem cell to develop into a given cell type. In doing so, it may be possible to develop new approaches which bypass some of the ethical concerns raised by the use of embryonic stem cells, but we simply won't know until we do the research on the embryonic stem cells themselves. OHSU supports the creation of a fund to support research in this area. We also support the creation of a human stem cell research committee. I would like to comment that it will be important to have the right scientific input to that committee to advise it about the potential use of any funds which are made available through the language of the bill. And I finally just want to comment, OHSU does have some concerns about the provisions outlined in Section 7 of the bill, specifically the requirements outlined concerning the removal of identifying information about the patient. This may be problematic and could, if not carefully executed, jeopardize patient safety. We therefore ask that OHSU be allowed to work with the Human Stem Cell Research Committee to clarify the policy and the language of the bill in this area. In summary, with the caveats noted above, OHSU supports the passage of this bill.
Thank you, Dr. Grosser.
Mr. Chair. What I'm not hearing, is this currently already taking place at OHSU? Are you guys already doing this?
We are not doing human embryonic stem cell research at this time.
Okay. So what exactly are you doing?
Well, as you heard from Dr. Wolf, we are using...
Even Representative Greenlick did not understand, and I'm relieved to hear that. I thought it was just me. But what exactly are you...
So Chairman Greenlick and Representative Minnis, the kind of research that is going on is the kind that Dr. Wolf described, which is preclinical, using, for example, non-human primate models to be able to sort of test the potential use of embryonic stem cells and so forth. We are not conducting human embryonic stem cell research at this time. I would hope to do so under the aegis of this bill.
Mr. Chair. Could you tell me what the difference is between why embryonic versus adult stem cells, or what is the preference of why embryonic? Why does it have to be that method?
Chairman, may I refer that question to Dr. Wolf?
Certainly.
I was hoping you would.
Don Wolf here. One of the arguments that can be made is that embryonic stem cells are capable of differentiating into more different types of cells than adults. Adult cells may be restricted in their developmental potential. That's number one. And number two is that the ability to propagate the cells, if you're going to transfer cells into a patient in the context of therapeutic treatments, a huge number of cells are likely to be required. So the other issue is, can you propagate the cell types of interest adequately to reach those numbers? And it looks at this point in time as though embryonic stem cells carry the greatest potential in that regard. So those are two of the arguments. But again, we would come back to say that in the end, we don't know for sure. And our approach ideally would be to study both adult stem cells as well as embryonic stem cells.
Mr. Chair, kind of a follow-up to that, what about cord blood, and why is that less of an intriguing path to follow?
Does anybody else want to deal with that?
Well, Representative Green, Representative Maurer. There have been some promising reports using amniotic fluid and the potential for cord blood. I think that one of the problems there, again, is the sheer number of cells that are available. Under current conditions, it's difficult to imagine the number of cells being available through that methodology. But it is, in fact, a very interesting set of reports that are coming out from that area, and those would be pursued as well to test the possibility that those would be sources.
Dr. Wynn?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Wynn. I'm a neurologist here in town. Thank you for allowing me to give me a few minutes to talk. Also, I thank Representative Glezio for inviting me, and thank you to the committee members for expressing interest in this topic. Also, I don't know how you guys manage two lives at once, serving here in Salem and also having your life, so I commend you for your service for that. As I said, my name is Mike Wynn. I'm a board-certified neurologist here in Salem, and as a background, after medical school, I served as a general medical officer and flight surgeon in the Air Force for 4 years, then returned to Oregon and did my neurology residency at OHSU, followed that with a two-year stroke fellowship in cerebral vascular disease, and then opened my practice here in town in 1997. So I've been kind of in the trenches since 1997. I support this bill, and I'll give you two reasons, or I'll start off with two reasons why I support it. The first is 2 weeks ago in my office, I saw a gentleman, takes good care of himself, exercises regularly, does not smoke, does not drink, came in because he's having a hard time at his job little tremor in his right hand. And his wife was with him, and she said that he also cannot keep up with her when they go on their walk. He's walking a little slower. So after an evaluation and testing, sure enough, I brought them back and told them that he has Parkinson's disease. This gentleman's 45 years old. Got a lot of years in front of them. The other case, the other reason that we should think hard about stem cells is a 65-year-old woman, retired from teaching, 30 years, very active, brought in by her husband, who said she was having a hard time in her retirement organizing herself, organizing her day, having some memory problems, and you know where I'm going with this. After a full evaluation, I brought them both back and had the privilege of telling her she has early Alzheimer's disease. And these are both early cases, so they have years and years in front of them. I don't bring these cases up to elicit sympathy because I know you all empathize with these cases and other citizens you're going to hear about today. Rather, I bring them up because they are a common problem in neurology, and much in medicine, but especially in neurology, and that is patients come in who haven't done anything wrong. They have good habits, they take care of themselves, and they still get these diseases. So what's up with that? Why are they getting these diseases? Well, the last 15 years or so have shown it's probably a genetic issue. Certain genes in certain cells in their brain aren't working right. They're either producing too much of something, they're not producing enough of something, or they're not processing a protein correctly. And then brain cells die. Then the patients get these diseases. So how does this relate to stem cells? Well, stem cells, embryonic stem cells especially, are an excellent tool for studying how genes work. And we can draw stem cells from different organs also and study the specific type of cell and how genes work. And that's a very unique tool that we have now that we did not have in the past. It's really only 10, 15 years old or so. So that's really quite important. Stem cells, you've heard already, and you'll hear again how important they are for therapy. I'd like to say, maybe emphasize the point, they're important for other things, like, for instance, diagnosis. By studying stem cells and learning about the genetic apparatus, we can learn about normal functioning and develop ways of diagnosing disease earlier. One of the cardinal points of modern-day neurology is the earlier you can diagnose a disease, this goes for other areas, the sooner you can intervene. And you can prevent onset of symptoms and prevent disability, or at least delay disability. So stem cells are good for therapy and diagnosis. Stem cells have potential also for testing. So if we have a new medicine and we want to test it for disease X, we can do it in a human being. It's going to cost a lot of money. It's got risk, and we do that. We have to. Wouldn't it be nice to take the exact same cell type or a cell type that has certain genetic mechanisms you want to look at, put in a dish, and then test your medicine? A lot quicker. It's going to be expensive, but certainly there are different issues in studying in human beings. So stem cells also have great potential for testing. So therapy, diagnosis, and testing. All of it's not just therapy. Let me emphasize the point. Please do not equate embryonic stem cells with adult stem cells. Thank you, Representative Minister, for asking that question, because that's a really critical point. Same thing with cord blood. They all have different characteristics that have been touched upon, and the real answer is they all have to be studied. I'll close with an analogy, which I know is a bit risky, but then I'll close and ask questions or answer questions. We're fighting against, it's a basketball analogy, so the other team is the diseases, and they have five all-stars. They're good. And we have imaging, we've got some good medicines, we have non-invasive surgical techniques. We have about four players on the floor. We really need that fifth player. It's like going out there without a point guard. I think you should look at stem cells as that fifth player. It is, it would be inappropriate and, frankly, a losing proposition to go out there without all the team members on our team on our side. So I strongly encourage the committee to consider this bill and endorse this bill. I'm happy to take questions.
Mr. Chair?
Kim?
I do have a question. I'm not sure it's to you. It might be. It sort of goes back to the research, and so any of you can take this on. But as I try to wrap my head around what we're contemplating, what you're working on, I come up with the following. On the therapeutic cloning side, understanding that this is only one of the purposes to which this kind of research can go, but the goal ultimately is to create cells that have a specific function that will not be rejected by the recipient. So differentiated cells. To do that, you start with an egg and a skin cell from the ultimate recipient. I guess, when is that egg fertilized?
Yeah, okay.
And so take me the step, because we went through it really quickly on the schematic, and I'm trying to sort of put this together in my head.
So you're kind of talking about, in a way, somatic, which is body soma, body stem cells. You're alluding to that. It's really not fertilization. You take the genetic material out of a skin cell, out of a blood cell. Pick it. You take just the genetic material out, and you put that in an egg that's been, in a way, I'm going to be very crude here, emptied. Okay, it doesn't have any genetic material. You take, that's what you're doing. So fertilization is not a term I would quite use, because that suggests an intact egg and sperm, and that's not what we're talking about with adult, with the stem nuclear transfer that was described earlier.
And so
there's no fertilization.
Inuculated refers to the fact that it's been emptied.
Correct. The nucleus,
and then
right.
The insertion of that adult my
correct.
Skin cell into that empty egg, then by some magic, it begins to divide itself. I'm sorry, I'm not...
No, that's good, that's fine. It's pretty cool, it's pretty amazing.
Okay.
The enucleated egg has no genetic material. Mm-hmm. That's that cyst kind of thing, and you take nuclear material from another cell and put it in there. Then the egg itself will start the process of dividing into multiple cells.
Okay, thank you very much for your clarification.
Thank you all very much. Thanks for coming. We really appreciate it. Can I call Dr. Nuremberg, Gail and Gary Snow, and Gail Atterbury, please? Both Snows or one? What do we got?
Until their testimony's
over,
and then
I'll sit up. Be great. Am I reading the name right? Is it Nuremberg?
Nuremberg.
Let's see how close they are. Snows, why don't you start, huh? Hmm? Oh, we're trying to get the computer organized there.
Okay. Who do I hand this to? Mm-hmm.
Please start by introducing yourself.
Hi, I'm Gail Snow.
And I'm Gary Snow.
And we have a written testimony. It was easier for me to write it down than to remember everything I wanted to say. So if you don't mind, I'll just go ahead and read it. During the year of 2005, Gary was experiencing fatigue and weakness. Because he had had a heart condition, we didn't put much thought to this, just thought it was symptoms of the heart condition. In November of 2005, Gary and his brother Steve went on a short-term mission trip to Kenya, Africa. During the flight over there and during the mission trip, Gary became extremely fatigued and weak, and he also developed a bad cough. By the time he arrived back home, about the third week of November, he was very ill, and we immediately went to a physician. The cough had become so severe that Gary thought he had pneumonia, but an x-ray showed that his lungs were clear, and we just went home to write it out. Finally, the cough subsided, but however, the fatigue and weakness grew worse. On New Year's Eve of 2005, I was babysitting grandchildren that day, and by the time I got home, Gary was sitting in a chair with blankets on him, shivering, and the pellet stove had gone out. And when I asked him why he let the pellet stove go out, he said he was too weak to even lift a bag of pellets to refill it. This caused a lot of frightening fright to me because I was thinking of African diseases. You know, what did he pick up over there? And so I insisted that we go to the emergency room that night. The attending physician took blood samples and revealed the results to us. Gary was extremely anemic, and the physician also told us that his iron count was fine, and so that we should investigate this further by going to our family physician to try to determine the cause of his anemia. So in January of 2006, our family physician began to order tests to search for the cause of his anemia. After several blood tests to rule out anything that he could have picked up in Africa, they all came back negative, and so the doctor became a little more aggressive into determining why Gary was anemic. He did a lot of other tests to determine if there was any internal bleeding, ulcers, or anything. And when none of these came back positive, and we still didn't have an answer. In February, he decided that the last test he would do, which would probably give us more answers, was a bone marrow biopsy. And this frightened us a lot because every time you hear of someone having a bone marrow biopsy, you realize that something more serious is going on. Finally, in March of 2006, we had an answer to the cause of his anemia. This answer wasn't one we wanted to hear. Gary was diagnosed with myelodysplasia, a bone marrow disease. He also had monosomy 7, which is a chromosome defect directly related to myelodysplasia. He was actually missing the chromosome 7. Because of this abnormality in the chromosome, we were told that his disease would progress at a faster rate than someone with myelodysplasia who didn't have a chromosome defect. We were told that there was no cure for myelodysplasia, but that they could improve his quality of life during the remaining time that he had. This improvement involved bimonthly injections of Aranesp, a drug which is supposed to build up your blood count so that he wouldn't feel as tired and weak. Gary's blood counts didn't rise during the first few weeks, and so they started weekly injections. And when this didn't help, we finally asked for a second opinion. We were finally referred to Dr. Peter Curtin at OHSU, and our first visit to him was April 2006. Dr. Curtin was, I'm sorry, this is emotional. But Dr. Curtin was the first person to offer any hope in this situation. He told us that OHSU has been having good results in curing this disease with bone marrow transplant, and that Gary needed to have this done as quickly as possible. Quickly because of the monosomy 7, the chromosome defect. Of course, we went home feeling elated that something could be done. We were told to continue with the weekly injections while we waited. After we arrived home, we put together a list of Gary's 6 siblings and sent them to Dr. Curtin, who then ordered the tissue type testing for all of them. In late June of 2006, we received the good news that 2 of Gary's siblings were a match. Dr. Curtin chose Gary's brother Steve as the donor because a brother-to-brother match, male-to-male match, had a better chance than a sister-to-brother chance. And because of Gary's age and the age of the donor, Dr. Curtin wanted the best possible match for this situation. We were given a 60% chance of a cure. This may not sound so good to some people, but back in February, we were told there was no cure, so 60% sounded like a miracle to us. We were also told that the type of transplant that they would be performing was called an autogenic blood stem cell transplant. This is a transplant using adult stem cells from another person, in this case, Gary's brother, Steve. The doctors at OHSU are using this type of transplant more and more because it is less invasive than the bone marrow collection, and it has been very successful. The stem cell transplant was scheduled for August 31st of 2006. We rented an apartment near OHSU because we needed to be near the hospital for approximately 6 months. We arrived at OHSU a week prior to the scheduled date of the transplant so Gary could begin chemotherapy to destroy his diseased bone marrow. Gary's brother Steve arrived a few days after us as an outpatient to begin daily injections of a colony-stimulating factor, also called a growth factor, which increases the number of cells in the collections. Steve had 2 collections done, one on August 31st, which was then given to Gary, and another on September 1st, which Gary also received. Gary was in the hospital for approximately 3 weeks after the transplant. He came home to the apartment we rented, and then we began the weekly trips to the clinic for follow-up. 60 days after the transplant, another bone marrow biopsy was done. This time the results overjoyed us. Gary was free of myelodysplasia, and chromosome 7 had returned. He was also 100% of his donor's DNA, and the doctors had hoped by at that time that he would be at least 60%. Just before Christmas of 2006, we were given the permission to head back home to Rogue River. Gary was doing great, even much better than the doctors had anticipated. Today, 7 months after the transplant, Gary is continuing to do well. We are careful to avoid exposure to germs because he is still on immunosuppressive drugs while we wait for his counts to rise. His medications are slowly being decreased each month, and Gary is back to doing the things he loved to do. He is no longer as fatigued, and as his blood counts rise, he will even have more energy to do the things he loved. We owe Gary's life not only to God, but to the adult stem cells that saved his life. In addition, Gary and I would like to add that we are opposed to embryonic stem cell research because life begins at the moment of conception. With the success of adult stem cell transplant, we feel it is morally wrong to create life just for the stem cells and then to destroy life.
Are there any questions? I would like to ask you a question. I'll see if I can put it as delicately as I can. And we've also heard some testimony that conception isn't a part of what we're talking about, but Gary was able to get this miraculous recovery because of research that's been going on at the university over the last, say, decade, maybe more. There are couples like you that there isn't a cure for, and if you thought that cure could come out of embryonic stem cell research, that would allow another couple to come and testify here on their cure for Parkinson's or their cure for multiple sclerosis or their cure from Alzheimer's, would you still not want to allow that to happen?
Well, I'll answer, and he can answer on his own if he wants. I feel that there is enough evidence that adult stem cells are working, and I'm not against stem cell research. I think that we could research more on the adult stem cells, maybe even the umbilical cord stem cells, without having to do the embryonic.
Gary, do you have a comment?
I feel the same way. We have enough babies being born every day, and we just throw the waste away that they could use for a lot more testing. And I just think that if we are creating a life to destroy it, it's wrong.
Thank you. You ready? Do we have a computer going? We're running out of time.
Well, it's 4 minutes to pick up on one here.
Gail, do you want to come and talk while we're waiting for the computer?
Are you ready?
It's not coming up there, so that's a problem that I can't fix. Unless I guess we're there.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick. My name is Gail Atterbury. I'm the Director of Oregon Right to Life. And as such, today I particularly want to emphasize that I do represent the viewpoint of hundreds of thousands of Oregonians as I oppose HB 2801. I was going to follow Dr. Nirenberg, but she'll catch you up to date say things that you don't understand, which I think you are going to understand everything I say. Each embryo is a unique human life. I think we can agree on that. Each embryo at the blastocyst stage, which is the stage we're talking about when we talk about embryonic stem cells, each embryo at this blastocyst stage, even though very tiny, is a unique human life. Embryonic stem cells can only be obtained by killing a living human embryo at the blastocyst stage. Each of us in this room was once a blastocyst, and none of us would be alive if we had been used for stem cell research. Deliberately killing innocent human life, no matter how small, and even with the hope that someone might be helped, is unethical. Embryonic stem cell research is a highly divisive issue, one that hundreds of thousands of our Oregonians find morally offensive. While, unfortunately, to me, embryonic stem cell research and human cloning is legal, using taxpayer dollars for this unethical research is highly offensive to a majority of Oregonians. In our zeal to find cures for diseases, it is critical that we not lose sight of the inherent value of each human life. Point two, HB 2801 is unnecessary. So far, years of embryonic stem cell research has not produced one single cure or treatment. And I do have footnotes and for all of these statements that I'm making. And you will find them listed at the bottom, plus in the handouts that have been given to you. One substantial problem with embryonic stem cells is their rapid growth, causing tumors in test animals. And this is one thing we have not been able to overcome yet, is the tumor factor that embryonic stem cells create. And one reason is because they grow so fast, which is what they're programmed to do when, in fact, they are in the womb, is to grow fast. Point two, while research with embryonic stem cells has so far been unproductive, adult stem cells have been successfully saving lives for years. We did hear one case. Adult stem cells are readily available in bone marrow, blood, fat, nasal tissue, umbilical cord blood, and amniotic fluid, just to mention some of the sources, and do not require the destruction of any human. Adult stem cell research is ethical and is successful research. Stem cells from these sources are already known to have cured 72 different diseases. Now, one of the handouts I've given you actually has a little scorecard, 72-0 as far as successful treatments. And then behind it, it also tells you what they are, and it gives you some references to where those tests have been done and have been written about in peer-reviewed journals. Stem cells from these sources are already known to have cured or controlled 72 different diseases, including many types of leukemia and cancers. And your attachment A, you will see that I just talked about. New breakthroughs with adult stem treatments are being published on a regular basis. Time does not permit detailing all the exciting news that is coming from adult stem cell research, but I've included you in your packet two examples, and that's your attachment B. The Journal of Cellular Physiology published an article detailing an advance whereby brain cells were created from stem cells derived from skin. Long-term possibilities include helping treatment for Parkinson's disease. And also in your handouts, I have given you some different diseases, ones that we all care about.
Just a timing. Mm-hmm. We have about 6 minutes more for this hearing. So.
Oh, all right. Well, then I want to quit and let Dr. Nuremberg go. And you have the rest in here.
Thank you. Okay. We have your written testimony.
Thank you for letting me come and give my testimony today. My name is Bianca Nuremberg. I live in Beaverton. And
Mr. Chair, could you ask her to bring the mic over her direction?
So, yeah, would you move the mic so we can hear better?
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So just because, in interest of time, I will compress my bio. I hail from Massachusetts, where I went through the public school system, graduated first in my class, went to Harvard, studied physics, graduated magna cum laude, and went to University of Washington in Seattle for my PhD in biochemistry. After I met my husband, I moved to Oregon, and I've done a postdoc at OHSU for a couple of years on the same campus as the Primate Center out in Beaverton. And I've also done some teaching at Linfield College, teaching pre-med biochemistry. So I'm hoping today to very quickly give you some essential concepts that you need to analyze the issues at hand. Okay, and I'll only give you one equation, no numbers, just words here, that science without ethics is unethical science. And for the record, I oppose this House bill. I think that it is unethical science. I've worked with several scientists over the years. Some of them have actually said to me that anything that is possible should be done. And I was a bit shocked to hear that even among my peers, there wasn't an inherent sense that the research we undertake should be ethical research. So here we go with just the science. I don't have too much time to delve into ethics.
Yes. You're not specifically saying 2801 is unethical science, are you?
2801, in my reading, only supports human embryonic stem cell research and human cloning. And both of those are unethical science, yes. So on its face, I don't support it. There's also a practical reason why I don't support it, and I will hopefully have time to explain on a practical level why I don't think that it's useful either. But from the ethics point of view, both human embryonic stem cell research and human cloning are both unethical.
You have 5 minutes.
Here we go. What's a cell? So, it's our quick biology lesson about cells. They are just pictured here very simply. In reality, they're a hugely complex biological living thing. Most of them will contain a nucleus. That's where the DNA is kept. You can think of the DNA as a genetic library. The human genome, which is the entire library, is about 3 billion pieces long and contains something like 30,000 genes, which are segments of those of the DNA. So at fertilization, we begin as one cell, just one cell, very humble beginning, but one cell, and through development, we reach adulthood, and we're now approximately 100 trillion cells. Okay. So this is in the natural state how this happens. I have here the release of the egg from the ovary. If it encounters sperm, it is fertilized, and the sperm contributes DNA. Also, the egg has its own DNA. Those two blend together. And here you can see a one-celled human organism. So it has one complete, unique genome. Now it will start to divide, and that entire library, that entire genome is copied. So those two cells at the two-cell stage have two copies of the same brand new human genome. Those two cells will divide again and so on. Now I just want to point out, as this embryo is traveling down the fallopian tube towards the uterus, it's approximately day 5. The term that scientists use to call that embryo is called a blastocyst at this stage of development. It's soon to then attach to the uterine wall and further its development, attached physically to the mother's body. Okay, so that's implantation of the blastocyst. So the life of a human organism is a development from an embryo to a fetus, to an infant, child, adolescent, and adult. And the life cycle then of our species is that the adult can produce a tissue, a sperm or an egg tissue, that then can be combined to create a brand new human organism, starting again at the embryo stage. So this is one main concept that I want to bring to you. I hope it's a tool for you to be able to evaluate different types of stem cell research that we're talking about, and that is to distinguish between an organism and a tissue. So an organism is a whole being,
tissue. We're out of time. I'll give you 3 or 4 minutes if you want to summarize.
Okay,
I can have time for your whole lecture.
Okay, well, I would request some additional time. I've traveled a long way to be here to talk to you, sir.
I know Beaverton's a long way. I come every time. No, you have 3 or 4 minutes to summarize.
Okay, so just basically I want to distinguish between a human organism and a human tissue. A human organism is a living human being. It's someone versus the human tissue has to be produced by a person. They have similarities. They're both alive. I'm sorry if I'm... Am I pointing at you in blind? Okay, I won't use the pointer. So I wanted to teach you a bit about cell differentiation. just say here that the cell types that are desired for treating these different diseases occur, of course, in our body during development. We have over 200 cell types, maybe thousands of cell types in the body. There are certain ones that are desired for treatment of certain diseases. So let's keep going. So stem cells are cells that can make copies of themselves, and they can also develop into specialized cells. There are different sources of stem cells. From the embryo, you're actually taking out the body cells of an embryo, and you also can find them in the germ cells of a fetus or in many non-embryonic, non-fetal tissue listed on the right-hand side. I just want to accentuate the umbilical cord blood, fat tissue, and nose tissue. Now, this is a key point, that in the derivation of human embryonic stem cells, you destroy a human organism. So there you see the blastocyst, and the inner cell mass are the body cells of that human organism. They're removed, and that organism has died. Then, subsequently, those embryonic stem cells are grown in the laboratory and propagated. So the human organism is killed at that point, and it will not further its life. Embryonic stem cells, should we see them as sexy or scary, and this is the point of view from the just from the patient, they should be considered scary, not sexy. Embryonic stem cells have been shown in the laboratory and actually this would be a necessary step in creating a certain cell type, is they form embryoid bodies. So they actually begin to differentiate into the main body types, because these are body cells. They begin to make a body in the petri dish. Also, a main point here is that embryonic stem cells, when put into an animal, have often caused tumors to grow. And that's because there's a similarity between stem cells and cancer cells. Stem cells grow and divide. Cancer cells grow and divide. It's thought by some that cancer may be a stem cell disease. So there's definitely a link between stem cell biology and cancers. Again, I'm trying to compress a lot of information into a short period of time, but from a practical point of view, this should not be very encouraging to anyone with a disease. You don't want to try and cure someone and end up giving them a tumor. So what is the best use of embryonic stem cells? It's to allow the embryo to develop. And here I just show you my baby from 1 year ago tonight. She was born at Good Sam. So my point here to make is that these embryos, rather than destroying them for their embryonic stem cells, can actually be adopted by other couples. And I've asked over and over to several people, is there any genetic matching that would have to go on to determine if an embryo could in fact be adopted by any couple and implanted? And so far as I've been told, there's no restrictions on who could adopt an embryo. So infertile couples looking to have a child may benefit by an embryo adoption program, and some companies have already been set up to do that. Now, coming back to this issue of avoiding tissue rejection, you basically have two choices if you want a perfect genetic match for giving new cells to someone in a cellular therapy. One is human cloning, and the other is using the patient's own stem cells.
You have one more minute.
Okay, so human cloning, and this was brought up earlier in a question. Somatic cell nuclear transfer is an unnatural form of fertilization. You're taking an egg and you're fertilizing it rather than with the DNA from egg and sperm, with the DNA from a donor in their somatic cell. So that is in fact a form of unnatural fertilization. And these terms of therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning are quite false. They're not useful, because if you're going to talk about therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning, you're going to have to talk about therapeutic IVF and reproductive IVF. The fact is that once you've completed the step that initial step of after fusion, you have a one-celled human organism that is then developing as an embryo and is being destroyed for its stem cells. So coming back to some hope, the patient's own stem cells can actually be used, and this term is a notion known as plasticity. So it used to be thought that
I need to close this hearing now, and I need to apologize to the other 12 people who came to testify that haven't had a chance to testify. If we decide to open this up, we'll open it back up again, and I'll invite you back. I thank you all who have had the chance. And I
quote, Chair, will you be having another hearing on this?
I don't know.
So we can.
I'm not sure.
All right. Thank you.
We'll see.
The temptation on some of these hearings is to try to get too many items
too much in,
on the
I know.
Agenda.
Yeah. We have another 12 people who signed up.
I understand.
Who won't be testifying. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2801 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3502. Are you going to start this for me? Adeline, I don't see you on the sign-up sheet.
Yes, I'm down.
Oh.
She knew she was.
She is in the sign-up sheet. I want to make a point before we start on this hearing.
Yeah.
I want to make sure this hearing does not turn into a forum for the argument between the Silverton Hospital and the Mid Valley IPA. So my intention is to make sure we talk about the issue in the bill, the question of A and B hospitals, particularly A and B hospitals that are within 30 miles of an urban area, which are basically B hospitals. And I've asked Tina Edlund to start to discuss to brief us a bit on the whole A and B hospital situation and the history, where that came from. But as I say, I don't want this to erupt into the use of this committee as a way to deal with a private squabble between Silverton Hospital and Mid Valley IPA. Tina, would you start, please?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tina Edlund. I am the Deputy Administrator with the Office of Health Policy and Research. Did you each get one of these? They're just coming now. Rather than have it up on the screen, I thought I would just use handouts. For some background, the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research actually collects and reports on trends for acute care hospitals, which is a specific licensing category of hospitals. There's for patients with short-term illnesses or recovering from an accident or surgeries stay. We don't have responsibility for psychiatric hospitals or federal hospitals. And I just wanted to state that for explaining some of the data that I'll be sharing with you today. So I wanted to look at how hospitals are reimbursed and how they're doing in Oregon based on that. There's currently 59 acute care hospitals in the state. 57 are not-for-profit facilities. For the purposes of Medicaid reimbursement, there are three types of hospitals. There are DRG hospitals, and this is an Oregon-only reimbursement scheme. There are also Type A and Type B hospitals. Medicare has an additional category of critical access hospitals. DRG hospitals the DRG payment system has existed since 1984. Under Medicare law, hospitals receive a fixed payment for each patient based on what diagnostic-related group, that's what the DRG stands for, a diagnostic-related group that the patient falls into. So if you can take care of the patient for that condition for less money than the DRG will pay you, you actually have some surplus. If it requires more resources and the DRG pays you, you lose money. DRG hospitals.
Well, I don't want to question, but can we go a little slower?
Oh, okay.
Is it critical to go that fast?
Okay.
I'd appreciate
it. I can
that.
Do that.
Thank you.
Feeling the pressure from the previous hearing.
Right. But if we
can. Okay. I can slow down.
Thank you.
DRG hospitals are primarily large urban hospitals. Okay, if we go to page 5. Now, for the type A, B, and C hospitals, for the purposes of this hearing, only A and B are important because those are the only ones under Medicaid rule that are reimbursed differently. In 1987, the Oregon legislature, recognizing the particular vulnerabilities of rural hospitals, and especially financial vulnerabilities, granted authority to the Office of Rural Health to categorize rural hospitals into three categories. Type A, there is a remote hospital. It's less than 50 beds, and it's more than 30 miles away from another acute inpatient facility. So those are the most remote. Type B is a rural hospital, again, with 50 or fewer beds, but it's within 30 miles of another inpatient facility. So they tend to be the less remote facilities. Type C is also considered rural, but it's usually a larger hospital, and they're reimbursed like DRG hospitals. They're not reimbursed differently.
Tina, can I ask a question?
Yeah, yeah, you may.
Is rural definitely in the definition of type B?
Yes.
It's not just size and how far it is from a hospital.
Is it also rural? Yeah. No, it's rural. Yeah, unless if I'm wrong, someone.
It can be less than 30 miles from a.
Right, from another facility. No, these are rural hospitals.
Mr. Chair, I just want you to understand that there are. Rural does not necessarily mean rural, and that there are numerous definitions, federal and state, in defining the term rural. So I think it's you have to be very careful about when and where you use the term rural.
That's right.
But if there were a 50-bed hospital on the edge of Salem, that could not be a type B hospital, is that right?
If it doesn't fall within, well, I'll show you one of the definitions of rural.
Because
there are. Representative Moore is exactly right. I think on the Office of Rural Health's website, I think there are five different definitions of rural there. Another important reimbursement piece is critical access hospitals. In 1997, Congress established a hospital payment system called the Critical Access Hospitals. It was aimed at improving the financial stability of rural hospitals once again. And these hospitals receive 101% of reasonable costs in Medicare reimbursement. So on the Medicare side, you have critical access hospitals. On the Medicaid side, you have the type A and B hospitals. And the type A and B hospitals also get reimbursed at 100% of reasonable costs. Reasonable costs are determined by the Medicare cost reports that every hospital is required to submit to Medicare. All but one of Oregon's type A hospitals, these tend to be very small. To be a critical access hospital, you have to have less than 25 beds, or 25 or less beds. So all but one of our type A hospitals are also critical access hospitals. Of our 20 type B hospitals in the state, 14 of them are critical access hospitals. So if you look at the next page, it's a map of, again, this is from the Office of Rural Health. It's a map of the state showing frontier areas, rural areas, and urban areas. In this particular case, and again, this is sort of how I came to understanding this bill was they just used the word rural with no definition, no specific definition of that word. So I just pulled this down for the sake of making this presentation today. In this case, urban is defined by a 10-mile radius around any centroid, any population center of 30,000 or more. So you just take a town of 30,000, a city of 30,000, and draw a 10-mile radius around it, and that's an urban area, and everything else is rural.
Around the center?
Around the center, the centroid.
The center of Portland?
Well, there's several, you know, Portland is made up of several urban centroids, so.
Mr. Chair, do you have any questions? Yes. Because there's a work group dealing with the medical malpractice. A great example of this, the black area are actually defined as urbanized area by the Census Bureau.
Right.
And so you have urbanized areas right next to rural areas, i.e. Ashland is a very good example.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the centroid is a central place, so it is 10 miles from downtown Portland, regardless of how big
Portlandites.
Beaverton could be a rural area, right?
I think Beaverton has more than 30,000 people in it, though.
That's right, it's another city.
The next page actually is, again, from the Office of Rural Health. It's a map of Oregon's rural hospitals. The shaded areas are, and again, this is just my take on this bill, looking at this language around type A or type B hospitals or critical access hospitals that might be adjacent to an urban area. If you look at that map of urban areas and you lay it over this map of rural hospitals, these shaded areas are the hospitals that, by my reading of this bill, are potentially affected by this language. Again, all of those definitions, none of those definitions are made in the bill, so it's impossible to tell. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about the financial health of these type A and type B hospitals in the state. We track, in the Office of Health Policy, we track financial health primarily with two measures. One is the operating margin of the hospital, and the other is the total margin. The operating margin is basically their revenue. You take subtract the costs from the revenues and divide that by the total operating revenue, and you get the margin. It's their surplus, and it's the surplus from that's generated from direct patient care. So it's their main activity. So we look for an operating margin somewhere between 3% and 5% as an indicator of financial health in a hospital. Just because they're not for profit doesn't mean they don't keep some surplus back. We want them to keep some surplus in order to invest, to build new facilities, to do some of the things that are related to their mission. They can use it to repay debt and other things as well. So if we go to page, the total margin actually adds in, that's the other piece, total margin actually adds in their revenue from other sources that aren't related to direct patient care. So there's where you would see money from, if they have a health district that supports the hospital, that money would be accounted for there, if investments would be accounted for there. So you'll see how that becomes very important when we start to look at this data. On page 11, you can see the DRG hospitals in the state. And this is median values, which means that half the hospitals are above this value and half the hospitals are below this value. And you can see that the DRG hospitals are right in usually the range of financially healthy facilities. If you look at page 12, you start to see the type A hospitals, and again, all but one of these hospitals has 25 beds or less. They're very small hospitals. It's very difficult to have an operating margin when you're that small that sustains you. Again, the median operating margin is negative in most years. It's negative for 6 of the 12 hospitals, the type A hospitals. In most cases, and then their total margin is not great either. But at least it's positive. And again, that's because most of these are, well, not, I shouldn't say most of them, many of them are supported by a tax district. Page 13 shows the type B. The type Bs are the ones that, if you looked at the shaded areas on the map, most of those hospitals that would be affected by this bill were type Bs. Again, type Bs are generally slightly bigger, although not consistently so. They're of different sizes. But again, you see operating margins usually below that 3 to 5% range that we would expect for stable financial growth. I mean financial stability. Page 14 gives you a picture of the payer mix of these hospitals. The type A's and type B's, again, the rural hospitals tend to have a higher proportion of Medicare patients. They're about the same on Medicaid. A slightly higher proportion of self-pay, which is typically the uninsured. Some of these hospitals, this is all of them put together, some of them are as high as 60% Medicare. And then just to point to the reality that, you know, geography and size doesn't necessarily dictate your financial stability. Page 15 shows the operating margins and the total margins for all the type A hospitals in the state. So you can see we have some with operating margins as low as there's a negative 19% operating margin, and there's on the positive side operating margins of 10.2%. And finally, the type B hospitals, only which one. Are the hospitals. Pardon?
There's only one.
Yeah, I know, there's only one. And then the last page is the type B hospitals, and again, that's the hospitals that are more likely to be affected by this particular bill. And again, you see that their operating margins range from negative numbers to quite healthy positive numbers. So there's no geography doesn't necessarily dictate here either. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Sorry I went through that so fast, but I just wanted to give you sort of a picture of what the type A's and type B's are and the different forms of reimbursement.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. We may have more for you before we're done. let's see. Is there some order here? Well, do we have any of the sponsors here in this bill today?
In the LRSA? Yes.
No, I mean any of the representative sponsors. Okay, Paul, you're first on the list. Scott, you favor this as well, is that right? Why don't you join Paul? Oh, well, there's. It's not just Paul, huh?
No, Mr. Chair, if you'll permit, I have somebody from Roseburg with me, someone from Salem. We also have a population expert from PSU here for you today with a quick presentation. And then I know where Mr. Gallant is here also.
Today's expert day. Okay, let's roll.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chairs, my name is Paul Phillips. I'm pleased to be representing Mid-Valley Independent Physicians Association. I also, thanks to the historical perspective you just received, will cut some of my testimony short as it relates to this perspective of A and B hospitals and the Oregon Health Plan at overlays. The problem we've got here today, Mr. Chair, is that a growing population and changing dynamics within the healthcare delivery system, how do you ensure reimbursements for services in overlapping areas as they relate to plan recipients or OHP and others are fair? It's an overarching question. It's a statewide question. Your policy consideration is without a statutory change, some medical providers and some providing services at a higher rate with similar are providing services at a higher rate than similar facilities could. Thus, monies allocated for patient care are not necessarily being utilized as well as they could from both an effectiveness and efficiency standpoint. From a purely policy perspective, Mr. Chair, here are three of the issues that I'd ask you to look at that are derivatives from Oregon's A and B system. First, does the existing policy which established increased reimbursements make sense based solely on miles without consideration of sustained profitability, the issue that was just raised to you a moment ago? Number two, under the current system, could a patient receive services at an A or B hospital at a higher cost than they would have from another facility that they actually live closer to? If this is true, then doesn't that negatively affect others who could also receive medical care? And if that's true, isn't that inconsistent with the original legislative intent in 1987, 1989, and 1991? The final and third point that you might want to consider, Mr. Chair, is does the current statutory construct actually promote and provide services to maintain the manner that is the most efficient and the most effective? Now, with those three policy questions, there's a number of possibilities of solutions. You can improve the methodology to evaluate current A and B subsidies. That's number one. Number two, you could establish a standard for urban centers, a mileage standard, because the mileage standards for A and B exist today. You could flip it and say from an urban center. Or three, you could give further tools to DHS so they could better evaluate the process. All three of those are reasonable. Now, let me take a minute to explore the historical discussion here. For those of you who don't know, I've served in both the House and the Senate. As a member of the Senate, I was privileged to help work on the Oregon Health Plan. It's important to consider that that was almost 20 years ago. Incrementalism works in healthcare. There's very difficult, very, very rarely do you get massive changes that change everything altogether. If you take that period that happened in 89, 90, and 91, and then you look at the other work that we did in 1987, 1989, and 1991 on rural health policy, the two create an interesting paradox that need to be addressed. Thus, I'm here today, supporting 3502 with amendments. The amended measure addresses an unforeseen consequence, quite frankly, that 20 years ago you probably couldn't address. But the bottom line for both the discussions on OHP and A and B debates, the issue was for Oregonians across the board, other than Medicaid and Medicare systems, how could you provide public dollars and use them most effectively? We created a system that we thought was equitable and that moved forward. But now it's 2007. Some things that we thought worked then just simply don't work now. Policies must keep date with the times. If nothing else, look at the population. 1987 to 2007, we went from 2.6 billion to 3.7 billion. But it's more important than that, and that's why we've asked the Portland State person to come in and talk to you today. It's where those people move to and how the classifications in A and B. Because, Mr. Chair, the question on what is rural and what is urban is very relevant to today's debate and what's a federal standard or a state standard and things. So protecting the system that's there just because it's there doesn't necessarily benefit all the recipients. Prior to the formation of OHP, when the federal government, along with the states, including Oregon, worked to fix the problem, rural hospitals was recognized were in trouble. We had to do something. So the A&B system came up. And the A&B system, 30 miles, 50 beds, and a variety of other things. The idea, however, at that time is no different than the amendments in the bill that I've got to you today. Regardless of whether you live in Portland, the Willamette Valley, Baker City, or any other part of the state, you should receive similar and reasonable services at a reasonable cost. Now, I appreciate your comments at the beginning of the hearing more than I can tell you, because some will say this is a bill between two parties. It is not. This is a policy that impacts parties statewide. Some will tell you it's about money. Well, it is about money. Everything we do is about money. It's about public monies allocated to serve recipients of the Oregon Health Plan or any DHS program that's administered in their recipients. It's a policy debate that affects all of us, the public folks, you, the private payers, and those of us who pay taxes to benefit and support those public processes. Now, as we look forward, there are a number of things that we could talk about, and I'll give you one example. When we developed the policy on rural health, ORS 442502 states that for the purposes of determining size of rural hospitals, beds certified by DHS on the license of the hospital as special inpatient care beds shall not be included. The statute goes on to define what those inpatient beds are. This definition, frankly, sets the stage for hospitals to stay under the 50-bed limit while expanding certain services in certain areas. That may or may not be a good thing, but it was a policy consideration that was not deeply developed if you go through the legislative history in 87, 89, and 91, where Mr. Gallant and Mr. Patterson were all there, and I was on that side of the table. But utilization of special inpatient beds needs a revisiting. So there's the global policy as well as the specific parts of the bill or the statutes as it works. You have a policy decision, that is stemmed by growth in population, policies that need to be reviewed, and new laws that are layered on the past and refined system. Today, I've passed out an amendment that sets a very simple solution. The amendment sets a 10-mile radius of residency confirmation for an individual who receives medical services under DHS-administered programs. Really pretty simple. This is for non-emergent care, which means it's for voluntary services received. It does not change the legislative intent of the current A and B system. And those who believe the current system is essential to the fabric of Oregon's rural health care delivery system should not object, because we are using the mileage system, a similar mileage system that the rural hospitals use going out from their facilities. It would be looking at urbanized hospitals and whether you're within 10 miles of that facility. The bottom line is you wouldn't drive by one and go to another. And if you did, if you made that voluntary choice, the reimbursement rate would be for the one you drove by. Today, since my voice is given out, and frankly, we had a good briefing on the history of this, I'm going to skip forward and say, I'd like Ron Preston.
Well, can I just clarify what you said? So if you drive by a rural hospital and go to an urban hospital, and your argument is the urban hospital should get the same payment that the rural hospital
would. My argument, Mr. Chair, thank you for clarifying that, because I'm trying to speed up, is that for the purposes of public policy, the lowest of the two should weigh out. Because, quite frankly, we're here saying these are public dollars to provide the most people the most amount of care.
Thank you.
But I would like Ron Preston from Roseburg, Dean Andretta, from Salem here to speak, and then we can answer questions if there are any, and then we have someone from PSU to speak. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Greenlee, Vice Chair Cannon, Vice Chair Richardson, and members of the committee, for those of you who don't know me, I'm Ron Preston, and I'm the CEO of Douglas County IPA, and I'm a fully capitated health plan for OHP Medicaid. I'm also an owner of Atrio, which is a managed care Medicare plan. Both organizations contract with a local hospital in Roseburg. While I'm not directly impacted by the AB hospital system, I am aware of unintended negative impact to the healthcare resulting from the current system. I'm here to tell you about two recent incidences that I experienced. Interestingly, a few months ago, I served on a search committee for a new CEO for our local hospital. Two of the candidates at the time were CEOs of hospitals under the AB system here in Oregon. One of the finalists, who was a CEO of a 25-bed hospital, touted a margin of 16%. When questioned, he replied that cost-based reimbursement and continual upgrading of equipment added to their margin. Needless to say, I was quite surprised, but anyway. Another example of AB hospital revenue imbalances and misuse is the recent hiring of an OR tech in a rural access hospital with one operating room. During the initial interview of the person, the interviewer commented that the hospital was doing exceedingly well financially, that they were not affected by the financial difficulties of larger hospitals. The interviewer went on to comment that new equipment, additional staff, or whatever else they wanted can simply be written on a list and added to their cost, as they literally could not spend all that they were receiving in service reimbursements. To me, it is appallingly apparent that a 16% margin and a never-ending supply of money for equipment and personnel that results from AB hospital reimbursement system is a misuse of public funds. It is, however, appropriate to provide adequate reimbursement to maintain the rural access, and I firmly believe that. And therefore, it is necessary to continue the funding of these facilities, but at a more realistic level. I also believe there is enough money in the Oregon healthcare system. It only needs to be appropriated correctly. Thank you.
Thank you. I think after the three of you, I'm going to move to panel of three who are in favor. We have to be absolutely out of here by 5:15.
Okay.
Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Cannon, Vice Chair Richardson, and members of the committee. My name is Dean Andretta. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the Mid-Valley IPA and the Marion Polk Community Health Plan, which is a fully capitated health plan serving approximately 33,000 Oregon Health Plan enrollees in Marion and Polk County. First, I want to make clear that we support the notion of differential reimbursement for rural designated providers and support reimbursement for those facilities that are providing services to patients of those rural communities. However, with the blending of rural and urban communities, Oregon Health Plan patients from urban communities are being served at what is now designated as a Type B rural hospital. The reimbursement at these hospitals for certain services are up to 2 times or more than that of the closer DRG-based hospital. Additionally, since the reimbursement to Type A and B facilities is based on a percentage of charges and not a fixed per diem or case rate, the variability in these payment amounts per case for these patients is significant. It is significantly variable and very difficult to predict for us. The issue has become much more significant in this past year due to the reductions in the funding that occurred last January 2006. We support House Bill 3502 as the unintended consequences of the Type B reimbursement methodology increases the cost of services required to operate the Oregon Health Plan. I'd be happy to take any questions.
My understanding from reading ORS 414728 is that the reimbursement is at true cost on the charges, unless I read this. As rural hospitals fully for the cost of covered services based on the most recent audited Medicare cost report for Oregon hospitals, adjusted to refix the Medicaid mess. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's
so
a percentage.
It based on?
Well, I'm sorry, Chair Greenlee. How functionally a claim is paid is a percentage of their charges, and the percentage of their charges is represented in their cost reports and as a percent reimbursement of their overall charges. So,
the way I read Medicare cost reports.
Well, functionally, as it is presented to us as a payor, we pay a percentage of billed charges, which is representative of the cost of the facility.
I'm sorry, I guess I don't. Because the bill charges are unrelated to cost.
Unrelated to anything.
Yes, but I understand. But the Medicare cost report is supposed to be a reflection of actual costs. And so is it based on the Medicare cost report? I don't understand.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Maurer, it is presented to us their cost as a percentage of their charges. That is how a claim is processed functionally when it is presented to us. So the percentage of their cost of their charges fluctuates with the cost reports that are submitted periodically to CMS.
You read the first paragraph of the bill, which is ORS 414728, says specifically the Department of Health, Department of Human Services should reimburse Type A and B hospitals and rural critical access hospitals as described in ORS 442470, identified, etc., fully for the cost of covered services based on the most recent audited Medicare cost report for Oregon hospitals adjusted to reflect the Medicaid mix of services. I mean, I don't know how it could be more specific than that. But that's maybe not what you're paying, that's what DHS pays.
Mr. Chair, if I may, my name is Paul Phillips again for the record. You'll notice the amendments we brought forth addressed the managed care statutes. The bill that was drafted, with no aspersions cast to LC, wasn't what we necessarily asked for and deals with fee-for-service. So you got two different subjects. So the amendments deal with the issues that we've been talking about, the bill. And that's why anybody that's asked me, I've said, don't worry about what the bill says. We're talking about the managed care reimbursement issues, which is what he is addressing.
The only thing I was reading in the bill was the statute as written.
not what you were proposing to change. I was reading the current statute.
Well, we are correct. We're changing a different statute, if that's what you're saying.
Okay. Thank you. Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association, and thank you for not asking me a technical question.
I know better.
Correct. As you have already heard, Mr. Chairman, I've been here forever and was involved in the development and passage of the structure, among other issues relating to rural health. This issue comes up about every other session, sometimes almost every session, and there are a number of fundamental, I think, issues that are involved that do, in fact, deserve, including the amendment presented to the committee by Mr. Phillips, deserve serious consideration, as we're all learning regarding the rural subsidy issue. Many areas of the state have, in fact, changed, and the critical aspects of reimbursement for Type A hospitals is fundamental. They would not survive without the current law that you have in place today. There are differences between different types of Type B hospital facilities, depending on where they're located in the state. That deserves a serious look by the legislature as the body who sets policy in determining whether or not there should be differential reimbursement based on the assumption of survivability of whether it be critical access facilities or Type B facilities. The Medical Association would support serious consideration for that evaluation, a rational change if that is appropriate in your judgment. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
But you support the bill and the amendments?
I would support the amendment, yes.
Mr. Chair, so are you asking that beyond this bill that we look further into this whole issue of our hospital structure, ABC, or you're just making...
There is no, Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, I don't think you have to look at Type A hospitals. It's clear that if they do not have additional support on reimbursement, they won't survive. There is a difference between Type B facilities. Type C facilities are urban facilities, and that's really not the issue. The issue is there a differentiation in the implementation of Type B reimbursement? Does that need to be looked at from a policy perspective? The Medical Association would agree that it does need to be looked at because there are, in fact, differences between Type B facilities, depending on where they're located specifically around the state. Some are more fragile, as you can see from the report that was presented to you on their operating margins, et cetera. You can very simply look at some of the total margins, operating margins that was presented to you today to see that there are vast differences between Type B facilities.
Perhaps I missed it. Thank you, Mr. Chair, in the earlier discussion, but I'm missing a very basic piece of information, which is how much of a difference there is in reimbursement rates between the Type A and Bs at their 100% or whatever the methodology is and the other hospitals.
Well, there's substantial differences. If you're paid at 101% of Medicare for the CA critical access hospitals, or at full cost, which is based off of charges, which is fundamentally correct, to get cost, even though this particular section of the law says otherwise. Significant differences between urban facility. I can't give you, Mr. Chairman, I begged you not to ask me. 85%
of cost or something for Medicare?
I would not be correct if I gave you a percentage, and there are others in the audience who I'm sure can give you great detail for that, but I am not that person. But there is, there are significant differences in that reimbursement rate.
Okay.
Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Gallant, I'd like to see some figures. Is somebody today going to be able to give us some figures of those differences or not?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that the Medicaid office can most certainly give you that.
Okay.
Well, I guess it was the interim. We saw a report from the Hospital Association, which had the relative reimbursement, something like 68% of Medicaid and 86 or 87% of Medicare. But we'll have Kevin Earle up here in a second, and we'll see if he wants to comment on that. Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can I have Kevin Earle, Doug Barber, and Ed Patterson, please? Dr. Shakova, how long a presentation do you?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Let's try and, we go to 20 after?
Mm-hmm. The police want to kick us out at 5. And I just said we can't be kicked out at 5, so.
All right, how about you guys seeing if you can go faster so we can hear from Dr. Shakova?
You'd be pleased to. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Earls, with an S, from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I am pleased to be here to talk on behalf of the rural hospitals and also some of the larger hospitals that are concerned about this bill. Let me start by trying to clarify some things that you've heard and perhaps refute some of them. And I know, Chair Greenleck, that you're very concerned about not letting this devolve into a two-party argument. Mm-hmm. And I won't go there. But I do think that it's important for the committee to understand that this bill was not brought by the large body of managed care plans, Medicaid managed care plans in this state. It was brought by one plan who is in contract discussions with one small hospital currently. And those discussions are ongoing. They met as recently as last Wednesday when we were to hear the bill.
That's
so I think that's
that.
Important for context. Mr. Phillips, I think, made a representation that this is an urban-rural issue. I think that was a theme that you heard in his testimony throughout. And I think that's the that's a incorrect foundation for the discussion. This is about small versus large. This is about small hospitals that have a very small financial base from which to operate. They have an adverse payer mix in many cases, meaning they have a lot of Medicaid and Medicare, which don't typically cover cost of care. They have a small size of plant. They may have a lot of unreimbursed care. They face a number of challenges. They also don't do a lot of procedures that are higher margin that a larger hospital would do. So this isn't about Salem versus Silverton or urban versus rural. It's about a small hospital being able to stay financially viable. And so I would ask that you keep that in mind, because I think that's really the basis for the original AB payment legislation. And what, in essence, you're being asked to do by changing this legislation is say that the original foundations, that A and B hospitals that are of small size, often 25 or fewer beds, but always less than 50 beds or less, that they have somehow evolved and don't need financial support different from larger hospitals. That has not changed. And I'll give you quick summary data. Representative Comp, I know that you were interested in some of this, but just looking at 2006 data, we have 11 hospitals that are A's in the state. They had a cumulative operating margin of 2.6%. That's an average margin for all of them together. Two of the 11 hospitals had margins of 5% or above. Two.
Four had positive margins overall, meaning two of them were less than 5%. And 5% is kind of the margin that you need to have in the bond market and other those that look at hospital margins say that's kind of where you need to be in order to be considered financially solid on an ongoing basis. Bs during 2006, there are 20 Bs. They had an average operating margin for all those 20 hospitals of 1.8%. Five of the 20 had margins of 5% or above. So one quarter of them had margins that were considered adequate by people who study such things. So it is within that context that you're being asked to strip or change the reimbursement that small facilities get because of their small size. Now, Mr. Phillips talked about if a patient that belongs in a health plan, such as the one that brought the bill, drives by a larger hospital and goes to a smaller hospital to, say, have a baby, you know, maybe that's the procedure involved, then the small hospital should not be paid their cost. They should be paid less than cost, which is the rate that's paid to the larger hospital. Now, first of all, I would say that that's inconsistent with the policy position of the state of Oregon, where we think as far back as Senate Bill 27 in 1989, the foundation of the Oregon Health Plan, that what we want to do is quit cost shifting, quit paying less than actual cost. We want to pay cost of people, providers, so that we're not cost shifting to the commercial market, to businesses and individuals who pay for their own insurance costs. Secondly, I don't think that we want to say to a managed care plan, you don't have to manage your people and move them to a facility that's in the backyard of our plan, a larger hospital. We will absolve you of the responsibility to manage their care and keep them at the hospital that we think you should be at.
Kevin, you want to wrap it up?
I would conclude there just to say, Mr. Chair, that we have a number of people that came last week to testify, could make it today. If you feel that this bill has merit and warrants another hearing, we'd like adequate time to gear up again, and we'll have a full-blown policy discussion about does it make sense to try and race to the bottom and cut provider payments to below cost from the only place in this current situation where providers are actually paid their costs, which is small hospitals.
Kevin, that's fair. If we're going to consider seriously moving it, we'll have another hearing.
Thank you.
We'll try and get some time for it. Doug?
That would be great.
Quickly, the police are going to throw us out of here in about 10 minutes.
Okay. I'm Doug Barber, here today on behalf of Peace Health. Peace Health has three hospitals in Oregon: Sacred Heart Medical Center in Eugene, Cottage Grove Hospital, and Peace Harbor Hospital in Florence. The Cottage Grove Hospital and Peace Harbor Hospital are both Type B rural hospitals and critical access hospitals. Tim Herman, who was the CEO at Cottage Grove Hospital, was here last week to testify. Unfortunately, he could not clear his calendar to get back today. But I have submitted his written testimony. Let me just highlight a couple of pieces of that. Cottage Grove Hospital was a small community hospital, community-run hospital, that in the late 1990s had been in existence for 50 years, went bankrupt because of reimbursement, and closed. The community asked Peace Health to come in to see if they could find a way to reopen that facility. Peace Health, the only way that worked was to get critical access designation. Because of some technicalities, it required a change in federal law to do that. Senator Wyden, Senator Smith, and Congressman DeFazio were successful in doing that. So Cottage Grove Hospital became the first rural hospital in the state with that critical access designation. It allowed it to reopen, and it currently serves a population base in southern Lane County and northern Douglas County that was not being served, would not be served without the cost-based reimbursement. That was the critical component that allowed that hospital to reopen and to serve that community. and I'll let you read through the written testimony with more detail. I'd be happy to answer questions or to bring Tim Herman back if you decide to go further with this.
Interesting to know one of those hospitals had a 6.9 margin and the other a 1.9. It shows the kind of variation. Ed?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Ed Patterson. I'm representing the Oregon Rural Health Coalition. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, back in 1985, I was asked to join the Oregon Association of Hospitals as their chief lobbyist. I had just completed 12 years as a rural hospital administrator at that time, and I spent 18 years lobbying for the Oregon Association of Hospitals. That's 30 years, and 30 years I've been very interested in rural health and very interested in rural hospitals specifically, plus another three representing the coalition. It is really tough to keep these little hospitals open. It was 30 years ago, and it still is. You saw the charts that were presented. They have a higher percentage of Medicare patients, a higher percentage of Medicaid patients by a small margin. They have a fewer number of personal pay, a fewer number of insured patients, and just financially, it's a real, real struggle. Back in 85, when I first came on board with the association, I put together a rural hospital administrators meeting to see what our legislative agenda should look like in 1987. In 1987, we introduced a bill that defined the type A and type B hospitals and type C hospitals. That came out of a report that was done by the Office of Rural Health for, and I don't recall now what the report was about, but that's what defined the A and B hospitals. And the distances were in there also. We decided in our first shot at that to create cost-based reimbursement, we would use the Medicare cost report, which every hospital had to do then, still has to do for Medicare purposes. And that would define cost. It really doesn't define cost because it defines what Medicare says your costs are for running that hospital. So we were getting paid about 50 cents on the dollar from the state Medicaid program. All hospitals were. And this would raise our pay to the type A hospitals to about 90% on the dollar of costs. So it's not really making hospitals wealthy, but it has kept a lot of them alive. We've lost some in the past 30 years, but it does keep some of the rural ones alive. So we introduced that bill in 87. It was passed, and we chose, because for fiscal reasons, the smallest impact was on just the small hospitals. There were 11 of them at that time. And then we came back in 89 and we amended the bill, the law, to include the 20 type B hospitals. And that's how that came about. And ever since 1989, ever since, there has been some party or somebody wanting to cut the rural hospital subsidy, as some people like to call it. The reality is that they're the only hospitals that are receiving close to their costs for taking care of state Medicaid patients. The others are not.
And you got to wrap it up.
Okay. Let me just say one thing. There's two things this bill will do if it's passed in either form, the original form or the amended form. That'll increase the bottom line by 480 physician IPA, and it'll also create more of a hazard of losing some other small hospitals. But two things will happen. So we would urge the bill does not pass in any form.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Shakova, we're going to have to pass. The police are trying to get us out of here. We're going to have SB2 hearings in all these rooms. You'll find the chaos outside. I really apologize to you. If we move this bill again, do a hearing, you get to be first.
Mr. Chair, and I would like to just to mention that we have representatives from Silverton Hospital here who have attended both hearings.
Can you do it? I'm sorry. I'm going to close your pen. Let's let Dr. Shakova try.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention that I have representatives from Silverton Hospital present here. They were present last week. They would also like the opportunity to present.
Can't happen.
If the bill has another hearing.
Bill has another hearing? We'll be first. If Dr.
Perfect. Shakova. Thank you.
First. Ben, I need to leave. Will you close this?
Yeah.
And make sure we do it in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So please get to rest him, not you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. That's what vice chairs are for. I'm going to get out of the fire. I'm 15 minutes late on a conference call. I'm supposed to be here.
Where's the photographer? Are you ready to go?
Well, yes.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Cannon, and
members. Are you closer to the speaker?
The microphone. There you go.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Cannon, and members of the committee. My name is Irina Sharkova, and I'm with the Population Research Center and School of Urban Studies and Planning at Portland State University. I have come here today to provide information related to how urban and rural hospitals are defined. Urban areas have been growing in population, area size, and number. The 2000 census identified 72 urban areas in Oregon, including 7 urbanized areas and 65 urban clusters. Areas that are not urban are classified as rural. On the second page of the package that you have, map 1 shows Oregon hospital types. Oregon hospital types A and B by location in urban and rural areas, and it displays the distribution of 32 hospitals designated as rural by the Oregon Office of Rural Health. It shows that using the U.S. Census Bureau's definition of urban and rural, only 4 rural hospitals are actually located in rural areas. 28 hospitals type A and B are located in urban areas, in urban clusters specifically. Making criteria more restrictive and considering only urbanized areas, map 2, which is on the next page, and then table 1, which is on the following page, shows straight line distances to the nearest urbanized area for each rural hospital. 5 hospitals are located in urban clusters, such as Ashland Community Hospital, Providence, Newburgh Hospital, Silverton Hospital, Centium Memorial Hospital in Staten, and West Valley Hospital in Dallas are less than 10 miles away from the boundary of the nearest urbanized area. 3 other rural hospitals in urban clusters, such as St. Charles and Redmond Cottage Grove Community Hospital and Samaritan Lebanon Community Hospital, are located between 12 and 16 miles from the nearest urbanized area. While this presentation does not evaluate commuting patterns of residents of these urban clusters, such close proximity to major employment centers, Portland, Salem, and Medford in first case, and Bend, Eugene, and Corvallis in the second case, virtually guarantees that majority of their residents commute to work to the nearest urbanized area. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Sharkova. I'm going to close the hearing. I appreciate your speediness and
thank you.
Being willing to go quickly. With that, I'll close the House Subcommittee on Healthcare Access.